You're listening to episode 1 of the Publish the Story podcast, a Christian's perspective on reading and writing literature. I'm your host, Kevin Bounds. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. It was about a year ago that I came across a book that changed my perspective on reading and writing as a Christian. The title of the book is God as Author, A Biblical Approach to Narrative, written by Dr. Gene C. Fant, Jr. After finishing God as Author, I reached out to Dr. Fant just to see if I could have a conversation with him, and he was gracious enough to be one of our interviews on the Publish the Story podcast. This episode is a recording of our conversation. I really do appreciate Dr. Fant for coming on the show and being our guest. I believe this conversation will be an encouragement to both the Christian reader and writer, so I hope you enjoy. I am really excited about today's guest. We have on the show today Dr. Gene C. Fant, Jr., who serves as the president of North Greenville University. He's a nationally recognized thinker in literature, education, and theology, and he holds 5 earned degrees and has written or contributed to over a dozen books. He and his wife, Lisa, have been married since 1989 and have 2 adult twin children. Dr. Fant, I really would like to welcome you to the show, and I appreciate you taking the time to have this conversation with you.
Oh, well, it's my joy. Anything I can do to talk about writing or storytelling and add theology into it, I'm there.
Yes, we're kindred spirits like that. So basically, I gave a little bit of an introduction. Is there anything that you would like, anything more that you'd like for our authors or our listeners to know about you?
Well, I think I'm a big believer in providence and sometimes what the secular culture will call luck. I like to really attribute to providence, and I mention that because my first name, Gene, comes from the Latin Eugene, which means lucky or well-born, and my last name, Fant, is Irish, but there's like a slang term that uses the word Fant that means a dude or somebody that likes to dress up, and so I'm literally the lucky dude, and my writing story actually falls in with that. I've just been a guy who's been trying to seek after what God wants me to do. And it's been an amazing journey, to see how providence has led my path and has, really turned me into literally a lucky dude.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Somewhere I did some research on my name. Kevin actually means handsome. Yeah. I'm just going to leave that there. So,
that's perfect. I've got a podcast.
Yeah, I've got a face for podcasting. So, what's some things that you like to do for fun?
Oh boy, I love movies. My wife and I love to go hike. We live in the mountains of South Carolina. Yes, there are mountains in South Carolina. We're just up against the North Carolina border. And so we do a lot of hiking. The university where I serve has 30 waterfalls within an hour and a half of campus. And so, we love to get up into those hills and do things. We love the beach as well. And Charleston's just 3 hours away, basically. And so main thing now is when I've got free time, which isn't that often because of the kind of position that I have, my wife and I just like to sneak off and do something and have a little honey time and do that as often as we can. But I like to say wherever I am, that's fun because I'm trying to do what God wants me to do, and there's always joy in that.
Okay. Well, that's awesome. One of the things that I was wanting I was really excited that I was able to reach out and make this connection because I read your book, God as Author. And of course, you know, this podcast is all about the ministry of Christian writing. And I really do think this book just captures, in essence, it puts into words some of the things that I was struggling with at the time, trying to, I guess, connect the dots between theology and writing fiction, mainly, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and it really opened my eyes, and I really do appreciate you, this work, this God as Author. Now,
What is your story? All of us have this story. So what is your author journey? What has it been like?
Now, I've had kind of an unusual journey in that I actually started off as a science person. And so that was what I always thought. Well, you go back to second grade, we still have the little booklet, What I Want to Be When I Grow Up. And I wanted to be a paleontologist and deal with dinosaurs and things like that. And all the way through school, I took all the science that I could. And when I went to college, my undergraduate major was physical anthropology with a minor in human biology. And so I took classes like cadaver anatomy and things like that. And so when I ended up doing fiction and poetry and nonfiction and all the other things that I've done, that was a little bit of a right angle turn. But the way that it started was actually I was trying to do songwriting. My mom is a singer-songwriter. She has a syndicated radio show that's on WSM in Nashville, home of the Grand Ole Opry. And so I had the opportunity because of her connections to shadow her, and we did some co-writing. I believe we had one song that charted in the Netherlands for 1 week, but I got a royalty check. It was awesome for like $1.53. So I'm a professional songwriter, man. But because I was doing the songwriting, I started doing poetry. And went to grad school to do work in writing poetry. And my poetry professor said, you actually stink at this. You don't need to be doing this. But he said, you have a little potential in fiction. And so I started using some of the things I learned in poetry writing in my fiction writing and was starting to get a little bit of traction there. Started thinking through what that might look like. And then I had another right degree turn, which was God called me to seminary, and I wasn't really sure what that meant, but sometimes our responsibility is not the answers. It's just to say, absolutely, yes, sir, I'll do what you're calling me to do. And so I went on to seminary and then had another 90-degree turn. That's why I have all those degrees, and ended up doing a PhD in British poetry. And then coming out of that, began to see this kind of merge and overlap between fiction writing, poetry writing, nonfiction writing. The biggest challenge people have in fiction writing is a lot of times they're either making a point and they're sacrificing the fiction, or they're writing really neat, attractive fiction, but it absolutely does not have a point. It's just like emotions, feelings, images, and so forth. And so going through that, that was one of the things that several of my professors emphasized, is that most writers end up flirting with a variety of different genres. We actually have that in the visual arts, where artists almost never do just drawing or sculpture or painting or whatever. They do all of those things. And so what I tell people frequently is that there's no such thing as wasted effort and wasted inspiration. And that's so encouraging. For people that are wanting to write, what you do is you write. You don't talk about it. You don't think about it. You actually write. And then I strongly encourage writers to keep files. So if you've got a kind of an urge to write a poem, go ahead and capture it. And then keep it on file. And you never know when you're doing something else that there's an image there, a turn of the phrase, something like that, that you can go back in and weave in to whatever it is that you're working on at the time. And so all of that, you know, led to me being able to do some things. So I published some poetry, published some short stories. I was realizing I was not going to be able to make like a full-time living doing those things. And so I was teaching, and then all of a sudden fell into doing a lot of things with published essays and things like that. But one of the things the editors would frequently tell me is your essays read differently. Because there's this really strong undertone or turn of phrase that comes out of fiction writing, comes out of poetry writing, that allows me to communicate, at least I hope it does, to communicate with readers. And so my journey is kind of a long and varied one, and have just really enjoyed watching to see how God will take opportunities. My responsibility is to seize opportunities and to do the best that I can with those things. But the bottom line is that to be a writer, you have to write. It's not enough just to think about it and talk about it. You have to actually, like, sit down with your laptop or some paper or a moleskin or whatever.
Yeah, and that's really encouraging. I love the fact that you said there's no wasted effort, and that's one of the things that I've learned through this process. Just a little bit, it's kind of cool how your story come about through poetry and things. That's when I was a teenager, poetry allowed me to, get through some pretty tough times, and that's where I started. And that's actually before I was following the Lord and, serving Him. And honestly, after I was saved, the writing kind of took a back seat. But, of course, that's part of my story. I believe when I got saved, I wanted to be a Christian author, and God was actually calling me into the ministry. And for a long time, I didn't see the connection there. And it wasn't up until the last probably 2 or 3 years, God has allowed me. This is after I've pastored several churches and allowed me to, go back and say, hey, this writing thing is can be used for my glory. I think it was one of those things, a refiner's fire. I had to get my motivations correct, not wanting to be a famous author, just be faithful, writing faithful. And fiction is something that I'm really interested in. So I'm glad that, you brought that up.
Let me go back to the poetry for a minute, because you actually hit on something that's really common, and that is poetry comes out of emotion, and more times than not, that emotion is either frustration, or sometimes it's anger or something like that, because poetry that has no conflict tends to be really boring. And so the best poetry is what is skimmed out of the heart, whether it's like the loss of love or a frustration with life or whatever. And a lot of times it's driven, frankly, by the pursuit of love or the pursuit of something in life. And so, like, when my wife and I were dating, of course, I had to write poems for her and everything. I was this fancy-dancy little poet. And after we'd been married for a while, she said, why aren't you writing me poems anymore? And I said, because I married you and got happy. And happy poetry is not interesting poetry. Now, that may sound weird, but where that goes into the fiction process is that what really drives strong fiction is that conflict. And it doesn't have to be as bloody and as cruel or whatever as sometimes secular fiction writers will tell us. But it still works off of that same thing. If there's not some sort of conflict that's happening, whether it's an inner struggle or an external struggle or whatever, you're not going to be able to draw the reader in. You're just painting nice pictures. And after a while, nice pictures become decorative. They don't become instructive. And so for people that have started with songwriting or poetry writing or something like that, I think that it's really an awesome thing then to kind of have those there to the side. But also to start thinking through, okay, now what's a story I can tell that illustrates the conflict that's behind that poem? And, I think that opens up really neat opportunities in the way that we handle narrative.
Yes. I can see that. Along this author journey, what are some of the authors, that have influenced you, some of your favorite authors, and maybe some books that, that has just kind of guided you on your journey?
Well, I think I'll start without authors first, and start with storytellers.
Okay.
Because the essence of good fiction is a good story. And I'm from Mississippi now. I'm don't hold that against me, but I'm from Mississippi, and my dad's from Mississippi. My grandfather's from Mississippi. My great-grandfather, we're not 100% sure where he was born, but he lived in Mississippi. My kids were born in Mississippi. And one of the joys about being from Mississippi is that there are storytellers everywhere. And my dad's a pastor, so he was a big storyteller. My granddad is a pastor. He was a big storyteller. My dad's brother was a pastor as well, big storyteller. And I often will say that there's not a lot of difference in Mississippi between pastors, politicians, and wrestlers. They all can get really excited over various things. And so as a child, these are the fondest memories I have of my childhood, is at church on a Sunday night, having deacons over to the house or whatever, just eating popcorn or whatever, or having relatives over for holidays, and just sitting and listening to the storytelling that was going on around. And so learning at a young age to tell a tall tale, and then later to move to where I was taking stories that were naturally occurring and putting that nugget of truth in them that you do in good narrative. That was a pretty big thing. But one of the most common things when I'm telling stories and telling tall tales is I'll stop and look at my wife and say, am I making this up? Because a lot of times people will think that I'm just making up a crazy story and all, but typically there's a nugget of truth somewhere in there. In fact, let me give you an example. As I sit now and we're recording this podcast, about 2 miles away, there's a church that has a cemetery that goes all the way back to, I think, the 1820s. And there's a grave in the church that the headstone tells you that it's the leg that belongs to the guy in the grave next to it, that he had to have his leg amputated, and he will look forward to the day of judgment where one day his leg would be made whole with the rest of his body, and so he had it buried separately. Now, that's a true story and a wild story, but there's a truth, and there's a
wild
theological truth in there about a longing for wholeness, about the hope of the resurrection and so forth. And so you get that. And then as I got into high school, really is where, I was a big reader in elementary school and junior high and all that. But it was really in high school, I had some really exceptional English teachers who helped me to, to expose me to some classical literature. So like my two favorite, all-time favorite novelists are the American novelist, William Faulkner and F. Scott Fitzgerald. They sound sometimes like throwaways. But they're really interesting guys because both of them actually grew up as Presbyterians, which is kind of interesting. In the case of Faulkner believed in limited atonement that was so limited that nobody got it. And so we had a fallen universe where he viewed God as a cruel God who offered the hope of grace, but that no one ultimately was elect. And so in the stories that he has, which are powerful stories of seduction, of sin, of selfishness, of a culture that is at war with itself, he constantly is taking us to a glimmer of grace and basically saying, boy, wouldn't it be nice if that were so? And so as a Christian writer or as a Christian teacher, when I'm teaching those stories, I love to hold it up to students and say, yes, but grace is possible and so forth. And the same thing with Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald was constantly giving us these images of broken people. And essentially you're filled with this lament of, you know, where can wholeness be found? And what he basically says is, sex, alcohol, fame, money ultimately are not things that bring us satisfaction. And because he's not an overt believer, he can't take us to where grace is found, but he leads us right up to the threshold of it. And so that's why I love, for teachers to be exposed to these technically unbelievable, writers. But then for teachers, especially in a Christian context, to say, you know, here's basically what they're doing. They're saying, a lot of times we talk about creation, fall, redemption, right? That God created the world, there was a fall, and then through Christ we have redemption. What happens is most of these writers go with there's a perfect, there's a time of beauty, there's a time of joy, but then there's a fall and they can't get us past the fall. And that makes sense theologically because there is nothing in this world that can overcome the fall. We are constantly doomed to that. We're constantly doomed to a world that doesn't understand grace and redemption, but it longs for it because God has designed the world to reveal his grace, and it's designed us so that we long for that grace and that reconciliation. And so because we live in a culture that no longer embraces that and exhorts that, it's one of the neat opportunities I think we have as Christians is to be able to supply that extra step that sometimes is missing.
Yes, and you hit all those things in God as author, that, you know, and one of the things that I love about, or one of the reasons why I feel like the Lord is leading me to write Christian fiction, and sometimes I just good faithful fiction, is because it deals with Everyone is connected to the story. You know, everyone, there's a story behind every single story. I like to say there's, our lives are subplots of the story of salvation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, we can reach out to folks that do not have the worldview that we have. Basically, a novel is a worldview. And you were just alluding to that about Faulkner and you know, the various authors. They had a worldview, but they couldn't get past that certain point, you know.
Right.
And I think that's a good way to, I guess, backdoor evangelism, I guess, you know,
yeah,
kind
yeah.
of subversive,
yeah.
You know,
well,
planting seeds, you know, much yeah, like, you I, know, I, how C.S. Lewis was converted.
Yeah, and I actually call it pre-evangelism. And so what happens is that God, this is what I love for people to understand, is that God is in the redemption business. And because he's in the redemption business, he loves to redeem things that are lost or broken, even when the things that are lost or broken don't like to be redeemed. And so when you've got somebody who's telling a story and they may not have a theological bone in their bodies, or there may not be anything in the story that comes to it, I think what they're doing actually is reflecting the way that God has created us. I mean, I really strongly believe, and in God as author, I tried to get into this, that I really believe that part of the reason that story works the way that it does is because God designed us for story, because story is all about community and connection. It's about, we don't tell stories to ourselves. Maybe we do, and then you can go get counseling for that. But when we tell stories, we're telling stories with our families. We're telling it with our friends. We're telling it when we're in community. And this anticipates the beauty of story, ultimately, that it is about the relationship that we have, not only with each other, but also with God. And so story narrative is designed, I think, to reflect that constant call that God has, that is again hardwired through the universe, so that
yes.
we know that there is a God. There's something bigger than this. You can't sit and look at a sunset on certain nights of the year and not sit there and go, okay, well, that's just something's going on here. And so, I heard somebody say this, the first theological declaration that almost everybody has is the word wow. You're confronted with a sunset
yes.
or a vista or something, and the only way that you can articulate that, you can't get into a logical argument, you can't get into any of those things. All you can do is respond by saying, wow. In fact, I have a friend who's an avowed atheist, and he one time he said, you Christians get this all messed up, man. You understand that. And I said, what do you mean? He said, hey, here's how you need to be convincing people. Said, this is how I'm almost convinced. He said, don't talk to me about theology. Don't talk to me about apologetics. Don't talk to me about all this stuff. But he said, take me to an art museum. Take me to a musical performance. Take me to a sunset and ask me, what scientific basis is there for beauty and the moment where I
yes.
have to say, wow. He said, I'll walk through a museum and sometimes I'm in tears before I can get out the doors because there's something in that that resonates.
Yes.
And of course, and I'm like, yeah, that's because beauty is rooted in the very nature of God. It's one of the ways that God tells us that he transcends everything. And in beauty,
yes.
in story, in music, in all of it, and, you know, the old phrase for this was ecstasy. Ecstasy coming from the phrase to step outside or to stand outside. And the idea is that it gives us a glimpse of the world that is beyond the physical world. It is metaphysical. It's not just natural. It is supernatural. And so the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord, right? And so if you have this wow moment and you begin to think, hold on, maybe there's something bigger than this, and this is the time when we begin to enter into the portal in which wisdom begins to be imparted. And that's why I think storytellers and artists are so critical to what we need to be doing in our culture, because people are not going to remember an argument, but they will remember a story. You know, I mean, and this
absolutely.
Is what God gave us receptors in our brains that are specifically designed for narrative, I think. And these things, as they come in, they will accumulate, and the argument that is inside of those things will allow people at least to get the glimpse of God, and then we'll see what happens after that.
Yes, I read a book over, well, last summer. It's actually called Cultural Apologetics. I'm trying to find it on my shelf. I think Paul, is it Gold or Gould? I can't remember his last name. It's failing me right now. I can't locate it on the shelf, but it deals with that, that aspect, that transcendent aspect of beauty and art. And also, another book, Images and Idols. I can't remember who wrote that. I'll look it up and put it in the show notes for sure, as well as God as author.
And let me add this as well, just on this argument. I think what I'm going to say, I'm a university president and I'm a science guy. I started off as a science guy, but I will add this. One of the reasons that our culture now emphasizes science, technology, all of those things is because those are the areas where they can co-opt, they can steal the narrative. They can steal the story. If they take us out of context where we have beauty, where we have music, where we have story, if they can emphasize numbers and things like that, I think that they think they can remove us a step from those wow, aha moments. And this is the joy that I have in working with Christian scientists and Christian mathematicians, is the funny thing is that those wow, aha moments come up in math and biology and chemistry as well.
Yeah.
And that's what's hilarious about this, is that while I think that they are trying to take us into a culture where all we think about is the material world, the reality is that God made that material world, and God reveals himself through that material world in exactly the same ways. And so you have to come to a question such as 2 + 2 = 4. It doesn't matter what historical era you lived in. It doesn't matter what language you're in. It doesn't matter if it's 2 ducks and 2 dogs = 4 animals. It's outside of language. It is a part of the material world. But the question you ultimately have to start asking is, well, wait a minute, why is it so consistent? Why is it that this stuff works? And I used to say, in error, I used to say as an educator, that we do all of our integration of faith and learning in the area of, you know, story or maybe biology or something like that, and that math is its own thing. But here's what the early church and some of the early thinkers thought, was that math was the purest revelation of God's nature, because it tells us that the universe is governed by laws. The universe is predictable, and that means there must be a lawgiver, and there must be one who has created it with the intentionality of having predictability. But more than that, there's meaning behind that, because you can't have routine, you can't have predictability without there also being meaning behind it. And so, as they say, and this actually goes into storytelling as well, you can take the 26 letters of the English alphabet and you can mix those in an infinite number of mixes. But just because you've clicked over this letter, this letter, this letter, and this letter randomly, and you've clicked over another line that has this letter, this letter, this letter, this letter that matches a line from Shakespeare, the only reason the line from Shakespeare is meaningful as opposed to a random line is that it actually has meaning. There's authorial intent there. And so I think that it's one of the things that we get in storytelling is authors have intentionality, and we need to respect that intentionality, because that actually is one of the, some people would say even a priestly role that authors and storytellers have, is that they reflect the creative authority that God has in the universe. And I think that that's a neat thing to think about, is, you know, people like to play this game like, oh, well, the story means whatever I think the story means. Well, no, it doesn't. It means there may be things that the author has not realized subconsciously, but a story about a country boy going to the well to get some water with his friend Jill is not a story about Eskimos grabbing penguins off the ice in the Antarctic. That's not what it's about. That's to do violence to the meaning and to the linguistic reality of it, and so forth. And so we need to understand that that's one of the things that we do understand from story, is that authors have some level of control over the story. Authors have intentionality. And hey, guess what? That's because they're doing a creative thing which replicates this unique trait that we have as humans. Animals don't tell stories. At least I'm pretty sure they don't. An elephant may paint a painting for a zoo fundraiser, but the elephant is not looking at that and going, oh, this was done during my blue period when I was reading Nietzsche. You know, that's not what's going on there. It's randomness, and randomness automatically has no meaning. And that's just a function of that. So,
yeah. And one of the things I'm not sure, I come across this, and of course it's not a grand idea, but I believe writing is about as close to creating from ex nihilo as possible. Yeah. You know, I mean, because you sit down, you know, and it's a part of that image bearing, you know, of God, you know,
absolutely,
and that creative process, you know, like with other things we put together, but pretty much writing, you're sitting down and you're coming up with these, you know, these images and these, you know, this story, you know, pretty
well,
much out of thin air.
Yeah. And, you know, and in the book, God is Author, I've actually got an example about that, about a terrible novel that I wrote. It's awful. But going through the process, I was driven to write it. I don't know what was going on, and maybe this one anecdote is why I was so driven to write it. But when I was going through writing the story, all of a sudden I realized that my favorite character in the story was going to have to die. And I remember writing up to that point and realizing this story only makes sense if this kid gets killed. And I was like mourning. I was grieving, and I started to realize how much I loved that character and how painful it was, how emotional it was for me to begin that process, even though the character didn't know he was going to be dead yet, for me to be outside the story. And all of a sudden I realized, wow, this is a little bit about what it's like for God, that God is outside the story. He sees what's going to happen. He loves the characters. He loves each and every one of us so much. And here's the cool thing. I could not in that story intervene and rescue the kid. The kid had to die, but here's the cool thing. God sent his son to intervene and to change the story. And I just got chills when I started thinking through and realizing that about, holy smokes, this is helping me to understand God's heart for us in a way that I've never understood it before. Just like as a father, when I had kids, I understood God the Father in a different way. And so when we think about God being called the author and finisher of our faith, for those who wrestle with being an author, it is one of the epiphanies that you start to have, is that creative process gives us a pretty unique insight into the way that God, into the nature of God, and for his just incredible love for us.
Yeah. And see, that's one of the things, as far as when I was, I believe it was, like I said, you believed in providence. I believe as well. Because when I was going through this shift, I guess shifting focus in ministry, as far as saying, okay, it's time for me to start writing. I have always written, but just really focused more on this, that I come across the book God is Author, and it really did help me see how, you know, as that creative person, that author, you can expresses the glory of God. You know, you can really reach out and use that to the glory of God. And that is, I'm telling you, I couldn't recommend this book. I have more because I have almost every person that I know that is a writer, I've said, you need to read this book. So hopefully you'll see a peak and copies going out. I mine's so marked up, I was actually going to share some of the highlights that I've made. One of the things I wanted to ask, though, you know, when did you, I know a lot of people, and I struggle with this, you know, when did you identify as a writer? Or, you know, was there a certain time? Because it's one of those titles that no one necessarily bestows upon you. It's just kind of, you know, and you don't want to sound, you know, I struggled with it, calling myself a writer for quite a while, but, you know, is it
well,
when you publish a book or?
Yeah, well, no, there's, you know, what I would say is, you're a writer if you write.
Yes.
There are, and I said that previously, there are a lot of people who talk about writing and who dabble in it. And I think you're a writer when you are disciplined enough to actually write. And so I'm not going to say it's like 3 days a week or whatever, because sometimes you're going through the mental process of cooking. A lot of times people think that writing can be microwaves, but it can't. It's a crock pot. And so
I was
sometimes
about to say
by
that.
Reading, we're writing.
A crock
sometimes
pot.
By thinking. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
But the reality is that there are a lot of people who read and think and never actually end up writing. And so, I really kind of, started thinking of myself as a writer, when I was disciplined enough that I was writing pretty much every day. And I don't even mean like writing pages and pages. It might have been that I was just, that I had that little notebook. I used to carry little, I used to get them at Kmart, these little tiny, they were basically 2-inch by 3-inch notebooks that only had about 20 sheets of paper in them. They were paper. And I could actually keep them in my pocket, in the front pocket or a back pocket. This is before cell phones. And so I would just fill those things up with ideas or images. My wife was always afraid I was going to wreck the car because I'd be like, oh, 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 and I'm trying to write and drive at the same time. I hope nobody's got that on video, and I don't recommend that. That's what dictation functions are for now that we have smartphones. But the thing to be a published writer can mean self-published, and especially nowadays we have so many formats. Whether it's blogging or self-publishing or whatever, there are a lot of those kinds of things. But I think the biggest thing, it used to be that you were a writer if you could make a living as a writer. And now, there's a lot of things that are like that now you have access to more people than ever, but the paying formats are fewer than ever. And I think I read one time the average book only sells, average. I'm not talking about if you're, Dean Koontz or a romance novelist or something like that. You know, the average book sells, I think it's fewer than 200 copies. And at first that sounds really discouraging, but it's only discouraging if you think about it in the monetary terms instead of in the influence. That's 200 people. I mean, that's
– yes.
And there's some – it's one thing to speak to 200 people. It's another thing to have 200 people actually read something that you've written. And I think it was Al Mohler, who's the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. He was talking about blogs, and he said, it'd be nothing for him to have a blog post – that 100,000 people read, and he said, I only have a handful of books that have been read by 100,000 people. More times than not, it's 20, 30, 40, 50,000 people, and that's a writer with a substantial platform. I know one time I had an essay that I did that got picked up by a major outlet, and I think one time I had been told that it had been read by something like 500,000 people, and this was something I had written in, 20, 30 minutes, something like that. And so, if you've got 100,000 people reading something that you've written, you're a writer. Congratulations. Now, I didn't get paid a penny for any of that. I didn't even get a pay-per-click on any of that. But again, God has allowed me to have a career where I'm able to provide for my family. And what I do with the writing on the side is really part of my calling. But it's a joy to hear from people. It's one thing for you to know your mother's read your book. It's another thing to find out that somebody like Kevin Bounds has read your book. And there's just something really special about that. Or same thing with essays. I used to be a blogger for a major, news outlet, and, they had me do 2 or 3 blog posts a week. And, it was something related to higher education. And I remember I was in a hotel one time, and somebody said, aren't you Gene Fant? And I said, yeah, they saw my name tag. And I said, yeah. And he said, man, I read your blogs. I love them. And then, like, everybody else in the elevator were all like, you're Gene Fant? And it was a really surreal thing. But it's really neat because, again, you have that ability to connect with people. And this was a secular thing. It was not a Christian thing at all. But because I was intentionally trying to lay little things, just little hints and dabbles and so forth, that would be things that I would hope would hang in there. This is what I understand, is that the Spirit of God works in many strange ways. And sometimes we have a conversation with somebody, or somebody reads something, or somebody sees a movie, and God's Spirit is working together and all those different things to weave together ultimately the story that is going to call to these people and call them to grace, call them to reconciliation with God. And to have some small part of that through a story that you've told or an image that you've written or something like that, that's a pretty amazing opportunity.
It is. And one of the things that really, there was a time I wrote for a column in a newspaper, and there was a couple of counties over, you know, I got a letter from a lady, and she had actually written a check for $25, and it was just like a devotional kind of commentary. And I was like, wow, I thought this was just our county paper, you know,
It's absolutely shocking. In fact, I used to write a parenting column, and I would tell stories about my kids in it. One day we were at a home improvement center, and the kids were with me, and the clerk said, "Oh, Dr. Fett, and how's and named my two kids and said, "How do you like your new dog?" And all of a sudden I got scared, and I realized, man, people know way too much about my family.
Yeah.
And because you're just like, you forget, you think you're telling a story, and you think, oh, maybe a couple of people will read this, but you just forget how widely. Back during the Revolutionary War, I think I read this one time, that the average copy of a newspaper was read 20-something times by, you know, so 20-something different people, because printed material was so, well, think about that in the digital age, how many people forward things, you know. And so something gets on Facebook, some random person who doesn't even maybe live in the United States, picks up something and then they forward it over and they post it. And the next thing you know, you've got these really random stray things. But again, God's economy is not a random economy. It's a providential economy. And, this is one of the joys of doing these kinds of things.
Yes. Now, you've alluded to it, you know, what I would call BIC, butt in chair and just write, you know, now, what does your process look like? What is your process, of course, I know a blog post or an essay is going to be a little bit different than a book, but what, in general, what does your writing process look like?
Yeah, so for longer projects, the way that it works is usually I'll do a bunch of false starts. So I'll start on something. And then there'll be something that often actually it's a rainy day when I do this. I had a writing professor one time that told us your friend is the rainy day when you have writer's block, because he said that's the day you'll pick up stuff and really wrestle with it. And so for longer things, I usually will try to have a particular time of day. Some people do better in the morning, some in the evening. Because of the nature of my position, I end up having to write whenever I am able to. I also have ADD. It's gotten better since I've gotten into my 50s. But at one time I had pretty substantial ADD, and it was hard for me to write for longer than about 15 minutes, or I would just like start, I don't know, it was just like I just have a short circuit or something like that. And so I tend to write in bursts, but, what I'll do is have something that I've got that rhythm, that I've got that expectation. Back when I used to do paper, for people who still do paper, because there's some of those, I would never stop at the end of a page. I would always whenever I would get to the end of my time that I had, and I still do this digitally, I would stop in the middle of a sentence, so that the next day when I would pick it back up, I would already have that sentence primed and loaded. Because a lot of times a guy said, you know, the scariest thing in the world for a writer is a blank sheet of paper with nothing on it. And so I very quickly got in the habit of never having a blank sheet to start with.
That's pretty interesting.
True. Actually starting a story that would get the pump primed, so to speak. And then my big thing, and part of this is because I'm an English professor, really by trade, is edit. I tend to overwrite and then go in with a hatchet and cut stuff up. I used to very frequently have my upper level students in college, write a 20-page paper, grade it, and then hand it back to them and say, now turn in the same paper 10 pages long instead of 20 pages long. And that was a gut-wrenching process for them to go through because they couldn't puff it to do the 20. And so I can't tell you how many times I read books, especially by well-published writers. I won't give you any names. I don't want to have any enemies. But a lot of times I'll read, and this is actually a very common thing, I'll read something by a writer who's a really good writer, and I can tell they're probably doing a lot of dictating, and they're probably working with co-writers because it's just not as lean as it needs to be. And there's one I read a couple of weeks ago where all I kept thinking was, this book is twice as long as it needs to be. Come on, I don't have time for this. And what often will happen is in those inflated areas, you'll end up saying things that just aren't helpful. And so that's what I love about good fiction writers in particular who are muscular. Hemingway's not one of my favorites, but boy, he wrote muscular fiction. And there are other writers that are like that where, you know, you just edit. And so in the days the inspiration's not hitting, edit. If it's raining and you're depressed, edit. If you run out of steam and you still got a little time, edit. When you get the whole thing done, go back and edit. And even if you're yanking stuff out, I know in some of the longer fiction things I've done, I've actually gone back and pulled out chapters and have realized later on that those could actually be short stories. That's a very common thing in fiction writing in particular, that you realize, man, there's just too much going on here. And so you go back and you pull something out, you realize, well, actually I can isolate this. And honestly, that's how good literature ends up getting bigger and bigger. So you realize, you're writing about King Arthur and all of a sudden you got this little story about Gawain and you realize, wait a minute, this is getting too complicated. Let me pull this out. And the next thing you know, Shazam, you have Gawain and the Green Knight, which doesn't fit in the longer thing, but and then all of a sudden that becomes its own thing. And you see writers do this a lot where, they'll go in, they've got a longer story and all of a sudden they realize it's going to be a trilogy. It's either going to be a 900 page book or it needs to be a trilogy. And, trust me, publishers don't like 900 page books. And readers don't either. They used to in like, Russia in the 19th century when there was nothing else to do in the winter. But that's just not the way that it is now. So, that's all fun.
Yeah. So, what advice would you give to those who are aspiring to be authors? You know, maybe somebody that's just kind of maybe have this thing on the back burner in their mind, or maybe somebody that's just, hey, look, I'm just putting my toe in the water. Don't really know if this is for me. What advice could you give that person?
Well, I can go at it in a couple of different angles. One is, just do it and do it for yourself. A lot of times I get this with people that want to write their autobiographies. They'll say, how much money can I make? And I'm like, none. You need to write this for yourself and for your grandchildren. You don't need to write it for other people. And you'll have a lot more satisfaction if you do that. And so I tell people, just write for yourself. Don't worry about, all of that. But then if you do start feeling like, this is something maybe that I need to do, then you get essentially an accountability partner. There are a lot of communities that will have writing groups where people can come in and bring an excerpt. If you go back through history, you'll find that a lot of the greatest writers had friends who were also writers, and what would happen is they would urge and encourage each other on. And I mean, by the way, people who can actually hold you accountable, not like your mom or your grandma or something like that, or even a spouse, unless you got a spouse like mine who's actually a professional editor and who's willing to say, this is horrible. And then you have to be willing to hear, this is horrible. And so forth. And so all of that is good. And then the other thing that I tell writers a lot of times, people want to write their stories, almost in a vacuum. And I tell them, if you want other people to read this, you need to read what other people are reading. And so, I tell people, find some stories that are similar to the ones you want to write, some novels that are similar to the ones you want to write, and buy those and read those and see what's going on. Break it down. What's happening in chapter one? What's happening in chapter two? Is there a structure underneath of this? Where's the conflict? How is the conflict being done? What are the detours that happen? And go through. You just have to be ruthless in all that, because if you're not in the stream, remember, storytelling is in community. And so if you're not in the stream of what other writers are doing, the odds are that you'll kind of look like the crazy guy on the side mumbling to himself instead of somebody that's actually telling a story. And so, again, start, connect, and then get into the larger thing. If somebody wants to be a professional writer, I give this number one piece of advice to people who want to be professional writers. You're not entitled to be a professional writer unless you're a professional reader. And that includes spending money on doing things. So a lot of people want to write poetry, and I'll ask them, what are the last five books on poetry you've read or you've bought? And they'll say, gosh, I haven't bought a book of poetry. I'm like, then what right do you have to think that you can make money if you're not willing to actually spend money doing it? And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that, because it does help you to kind of get on it. But the big thing is, if you feel like it's something God's given you, then you need to do it and worry about you and God. Don't worry about others. Then if you want to connect with other people, then there's a path that you have to shape out of that. But the first step is, I think, obedience and discipline and so forth, and then you just see what God might provide along the way.
Yeah, that's some great advice. And you know, this conversation has been really enlightening and also encouraging. Just I love the fact that there's no wasted effort, Just even, and I also like the idea of pulling those things out of that file or that common book or, and saying, hey, on that rainy day and saying, hey, really start to wrestle with that. I really resonate with that. And I thank you for your time, Dr. Fant. And,
my pleasure.
I would really like for you to, thinking about the people that's going to be listening to this show, they're probably wrestling with all kinds of, fear and doubt and things like that. Would you mind closing us out with a word of prayer for those who, are just getting into this journey of writing or have been on it for quite a while? Would you mind saying a word
Absolutely.
Of prayer for them?
Absolutely. God, we're so grateful for your word and that the Proverbs tell us that the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. And so, God, I pray as people are thinking or are considering or wrestling with this, that they will have fear of you and not fear of failure, that they'll have fear of you and not fear of others, that they'll have fear of you and not even fear of themselves. God, give people the courage that they need to respond to you and to respond in ways that live out what you have revealed to each and every one of us, and that is namely your love for us and your desire to see humanity reconciled to you. So, God, I pray for anybody that's listening to this that they'll be encouraged in whatever their artistic form, that they will understand that beauty is rooted in you, that story is rooted in you, and that ultimately truth is rooted in you, and help them to know that they can love others through their work just as you have already loved each and every one of us. And so we pray all these things in Christ's name.
You've been listening to Publish the Story Podcast with Kevin Bounds. Thank you for listening to the show. I pray that you were encouraged to read and write for the glory of God. I encourage you to check out the links in the show notes for the resources mentioned during this episode. Please consider subscribing to the show in your favorite podcast app, and also writing a review for the show. Both help others find the podcast. Until next time, God bless and go publish the story. Thank you.